So, when I first started working on the history of psychoanalysis, I thought Vienna was the place to go to. And then I decided Paris was the place to go to. And then someone turned up in my office and said, I've just discovered a letter from Freud over in the botanical school in Cambridge. What was it doing in the botanical school in Cambridge? Well, from that started out a project which is still ongoing of the history of psychoanalysis in Cambridge. My expertise, such as it is, on Freud in Bloomsbury is a kind of spin-off from this. I don't want to go into this at all. It's just give you a vague map of a snapshot of 1925, the various features of psychoanalysis in Cambridge, which I call Sir Arthur Tansley, who became a psychoanalyst. He was the botanist in question who received a letter from Freud. He'd had analysis with Freud in the early 20s. And along the bottom is the connection to Bloomsbury from Cambridge. A little bit of a connection. John Rickman, who'd been at King's College, Tansley, Trinity, Sir Harold Jeffreys, the geophysicist, was at St. John's, died in 1989, and James Strachey and Frank Ramsey. Now, that mixture is an interesting mixture. It's one portion of this, this portrait of psychoanalysis in Cambridge. You can get a brief sense of it, but just looking at the signs I put up there. But this was a psychoanalytic reading group that met in Cambridge in 1925. The qualification for joining it was that you basically had analysis, and many of those who had analysis had analysis with Freud, Rickman, Tansley, Strachey. And they became early core members of the British Psychoanalytic Society. Now, some of them also were apostles. And the apostles, a secret Cambridge society, Conversazione Society, they called it, was the core of the Bloomsbury Group. The Bloomsbury Group was formed out of the apostles meeting with the Stephen sisters, Virginia and Vanessa Stephen. Roughly in the early 1900s, that group, the apostles keeping their Cambridge culture, Vanessa and Virginia, bringing their supreme literary and artistic culture together with the apostles, that forms the Bloomsbury Group. So Bloomsbury as a culture is this mixture of the Stephens and the apostles, led by G.E. Moore, the author of Principia Ethica, who had this enormous influence over the ethos of the apostles. Now, I want to jump ahead to say a little bit about Virginia Woolf's take on psychoanalysis. This has been gone over and over by many people, very intelligently, for the last 40 or 50 years. But I want to show you something that no one has really spotted ever before. So, new research, that's what you ask for. There's a very famous paper that Virginia Woolf wrote in 1924 called Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, or sometimes called Character in Fiction. And it's meant to be one of the basic modernist templates for what new modernist literature should be about. And she gave a number of different versions of it. They're all responses to some criticisms that Arnold Bennett made of her novel, one of her novels. So here we have two versions. One she gave in Cambridge. Whenever Virginia Woolf went to Cambridge, there was something special about it because it was a place she'd been excluded from. She hadn't been allowed to go there. And all her family had gone there. The family was kind of set up there in many respects. And she, as it were, met Cambridge as an insider-outsider but it was something she really responded to. So one of her glorious masterpieces, A Room of One's Own, is an account of the talk she gave in Cambridge and the lunch she had in Cambridge. Here, 18th of May 1924, her version of Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown includes this paragraph, from which I want to highlight the sentence, "If you read Freud, you know in 10 minutes some facts, or at least some possibilities, which our parents could not have guessed for themselves." Now, there's a wonderful irony about this, because it's pretty clear that Virginia Woolf had not read Freud very much at this time. Maybe she had read 10 minutes of Freud. But this was something very important for her. And one of the reasons why it was so important is because she and Leonard, her husband, running the Hogarth Press, were about to negotiate. In fact, the weekend after the weekend in Cambridge, she spent an afternoon with James Glover negotiating the deal, which became the international psychoanalytic series published by Hogarth Press, Freud's collected papers, and eventually Freud's standard edition published by the Hogarth Press. So Freud was very much on her mind, but he was embedded in an argument. And the argument was that something happened in 1910, something happened in our generation, Virginia Woolf's generation, which required that one recognize that our knowledge of human character changed. It got deeper, deeper. She says, "A vaguer force at work, a force which is sometimes called the spirit of the age or the tendency of the age. This mysterious power is taking us by the hand." Now, in the third version, the one which is the most famous version, she jettisons Freud, and instead she substitutes this very famous sentence. There are at least two books that have taken this sentence as their title. "On or about December 1910, human character changed." On or about. Could we be more precise? That's a very Bloomsbury joke, as I'll try to demonstrate. But I think it gives you some sense of the importance of Freud as a symbolic figure for Bloomsbury, and I take Virginia Woolf along with Maynard Keynes as my kind of two most wonderful Bloomsbury types. This is what Freud represented. This idea that something revolutionary had happened, and it was probably about 1910 that it happened. 1910 being a year, you could say, that Freud began to be read widely in England. So that's Virginia Woolf's version of Freud. He represents, in a sense, a spirit of the age. And in fact, a year later, John Maynard Keynes, in a pseudonymous review, or rather letter, in The Nation and Athenaeum, talked about him, Freud, as a sort of devil, a devil of our age. Freud represents for Bloomsbury the spirit of the age, and it's a devil in disguise, you might say. Now, they took Freud very seriously, as you can see, from very early on. This is Lytton Strachey, who wrote, always pining to be an undergraduate, he'd been away from Cambridge for 10 years by this time, he wrote an examination in sex education. I'd highlight question 2, the elementary section, write a short biography of Oedipus, and then wonder what you can say to "When the hens are away, the cocks will play." Illustrate this. How graphically do you illustrate this? This is a know-it-all question paper. You wouldn't understand what do you understand by the language of flowers means if you weren't a reader, a close reader of Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams. This is a dream which Freud refers to as the language of flowers. I think a very extensive dream. And the language of flowers basically means various forms of depiction of the genitals. This is what Lytton Strachey expected from his examinees. Now, we move on to Beyond the History of French Letters. This is a little bit too undergraduate, but the advanced examination gets more interesting. Bestiality, should it be encouraged? And if not, why not? What evidence of inversion can you point to in the works of either Sophocles or Rupert Brooke, as if they're on the same level? And this is one of the reasons why I date this to early 1915, because Rupert Brooke died in May 1915, and I don't think Little Stretchy would have joked about it in quite that way. Well, who knows? He was without limits. But then the final question, of course, is Dr. Freud analysed by himself. So, this is Freud in Bloomsbury already. And here's another sense, another major Bloomsbury figure, Karen Stephen, who I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. At a New Year's fancy dress party, she had gone as Medusa with snakes in her hair and reappeared on the first stroke of midnight wearing lilies, having been analysed. So you could say that Bloomsbury wore its Freudianism lightly and with humour, which is the way it did most things. It's part of the essence of Bloomsbury. So let's talk a little bit about Karen Stephen, because the core of the idea of the close connection between Bloomsbury and psychoanalysis is not only the way the Hogarth Press, via James Strachey and Virginia Woolf, took up publishing Freud in England, but also because four crucial analysts were core members of the Bloomsbury group. First of them I'll talk about is Karen Stephen. Karen Costello, as she was born until she married Adrian Stephen. She was a philosopher at Cambridge, a fellow of Newnham, and very closely connected with the Stracheys, the Stephens, Bertrand Russell's her uncle by marriage. And she and her husband Adrian, Virginia Woolf's younger brother, trained medically. They decided to become analysts in 1919, and they took the hard route, which was to train as doctors first, alongside their training analysts. She lectured to Cambridge medical students throughout the 1930s on psychoanalysis and medicine. But she had, like so many Bloomsbury people, had a stick in many fires, patron to artistic groups in the 30s and 40s. Her husband, Adrian, youngest of the Stephen family, with Virginia the next youngest, over there is quoted this passage, Virginia Woolf. It's so difficult not to quote her, because she writes this incredible prose, unbelievable prose. "He can't enjoy life with zest. I am probably responsible. I should have paired with him instead of hanging on to the elders. So he wilted, pale, under a stone of vivacious brothers and sisters." That's a portrait of her younger brother, age 40. Yes, 40 roughly. He had studied history and then law at Cambridge, was a conscientious objector in World War I, vigorously involved, as many of the Bloomsbury group were, in the objections to conscription. Note that conscription was the main thing they were concerned about, because that's a question of liberal politics. The idea of forcing private citizens, private subjects, to engage in anything is completely antipathetic to liberal politics of the 19th and early 20th century. Pacifism is a completely different issue. Conscription was the issue that the Bloomsbury group were most upset about. In other words, if you want to fight a war, you're free to fight a war, but don't include me. That's the basic position of the Bloomsbury group. However, in World War II, he took a completely opposite position, became an army psychiatrist, but at the same time, he fought a classic liberal campaign in the British Psychoanalytic Society, which he cared passionately about. He wanted to open up the British Psychoanalytic Society to transparency and democracy, in particular, get rid of the autocratic rule of Ernest Jones and Edward Glover. And so he was one of the leaders, one of the small number of leaders, who fought a campaign in the British Psychoanalytic Society to reform the rules, which were changed, and Ernest Jones retired, and the present regime of two-yearly presidents came into existence then, partly as a result of him. And it was very much a rebellion of the sons against the autocratic fathers, and he conceded it as much. Now, to give you a sense of what a Bloomsbury House style in psychoanalysis looks like, here are a couple of quotes from two papers he wrote. One is called Hateful, Awful, Dreadful, etc. And it starts from the fact that he was often translating German, like many other members of the Bloomsbury group. He was extremely well-educated, spoke four or five languages, did a lot of translation. He actually helped Alex Strachey translate Melanie Klein into English. I was casting about in my mind the other day for a good translation of the German Gehässig when the English hateful occurred to me. The obvious objection was that while the German word is used to qualify a person who feels hatred himself, the English word qualifies a person who causes others to feel hatred. This subtle sense of the language and the, as it were, the psychological preconditions of the language is what he starts from. And he goes into Latin, French, in order to think about other comparable instances, and then eventually he comes up with 87 examples in English he can think of off the top of his head of a word that behaves in this particular way. It's like a parlor game, but this is a Bloomsbury parlor game in which you're going to get to the heart of a psychoanalytic question about the relationship of the subject to the object in the emotion of hate. And that's what his paper is about. Similarly, in this second quote from a paper on defining psychoanalysis, I think this has an inner history because there's an implicit response to a paper, a famous paper that James Strachey had published the year before, called The Therapeutic Action of Psychoanalysis. Adrian Stephen defines psychoanalysis, the object of every intervention on the analyst's part is simply to allow more freedom to the patient's mind, to allow fresh fantasies and memories to come into consciousness, and to trace down to their origin as many as possible of his stereotype reactions. In other words, the only goal of psychoanalysis is freedom, greater mental freedom. And that's the only thing that the analyst is interested in, is the freedom of the patient. And this, as you might say, is a liberal political position transposed directly, very straightforwardly, into a definition of psychoanalysis. Now, the third of the Bloomsbury psychoanalysts was James Strachey. Virginia Woolf, Irresistible Again. Poor James Strachey was soft as moss, lethargic as an earthworm. James, billed at the 1917 Club to lecture on onanism, proposes to earn his living as an exponent of Freud in Harley Street. For one thing, you can dispense with a degree. Spot on, Virginia. 1966, James Strachey, having completed the standard edition of the psychological works of Sigmund Freud, stood up and said, "So what was I in 1919 when I first wanted to become a psychoanalyst? I had a discreditable academic career with the barest of BA degrees, no medical qualifications, no knowledge of physical sciences, no experience of anything except third-rate journalism." That's a reasonable description of what James Strachey did from the time he left Cambridge in 1908 to 1920 or thereabouts. He'd been pursued by the fourth of the Bloomsbury psychoanalysts, Alex Sargent Florence, who became Alex Strachey. They married. Nobody could really see what their marriage could possibly come to, but it turned out to be a very successful and rather wonderful marriage. And then he went off to have analysis with Freud, and Alex accompanied him. They both had analysis with Freud and became translators. James started off with the child is being beaten, then group psychology and the analysis of the ego, and then Alex and James translated the case histories. But the thing to remember, thing that people usually forget about James Strachey, is that he wasn't a committed translator. Maybe he was too lazy to be a committed translator. He was too lethargic. What he became instead was a very successful practicing analyst. For 15 years, he was one of the most successful analysts in London. Certainly in terms of the trainees that he came through, he was the second most successful analyst, more successful than Ernest Jones or Melanie Klein, with Ella Freeman Sharp. And you might say Ella Freeman Sharp and James Strachey sum up a certain British interwar psychoanalysis because they're both very sympathetic figures, very literary figures. And that's what it might have taken to be a successful training analyst in that period. In 1939, James Strachey became editor of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, and he began translating Freud again, partly to fill up the journal, because it had very little copy during the war. However, he had another fight that he wanted to get engaged in, even though he was more of a pacifist than Adrian Stephen. What happened in the controversial discussions, as they became known in the early 1940s in the British Psychoanalytic Society, was there were three terrains of battle. One on in which Adrian Stephen and Karen Stephen fought successfully to change the constitution of the British society to get rid of autocracy. Secondly, there was a dispute between the Viennese and the Kleinians over psychoanalytic theory. And then thirdly, there was the question of training of psychoanalysts. What does it take to be a good trainer of psychoanalysts? And James Strachey, who was not at all interested in any fights about theory or about democracy, and Adrian Stephen had some extremely harsh words to say about that. James Strachey turned out to be a very important figure on the training committee. In fact, he wrote the report that led to the huge bust-up, the reason why the controversial discussions led to a huge crisis. He wrote a report in training which he said people with extreme views should be excluded from being training analysts. Only people who are capable of moderation should be training analysts. And he had in mind Melanie Klein and Anna Freud, both of whom he had very good relations with. But if they wanted to put extreme views forward, then they should be excluded from being training analysts. Anna Freud resigned from the British Psychoanalytic Society at that moment. Melanie Klein retired to her tent, you might say. Edward Glover also resigned. So the old British Psychoanalytic Society went into meltdown as a result of James Strachey saying, us Brits only like moderation, compromise. And this is the way he talked about it in a letter in 1940. It's got a wonderful peroration. But the crucial point is that he criticizes Miss Freud, with whom he had a very close relationship, for maintaining that psychoanalysis is a game reserve belonging to the Freud family. And he said, I feel like Mercutio about it, a plague on both your houses. Why should these wretched fascists and bloody foreigners, communists, invade our peaceful, compromising island? So Anna Freud and Melanie Klein are here fascists and communists. but I see I'm more feverish than I thought. Anyhow, I feel that any suggestion of a split in society ought to be condemned and resisted to the utmost, And that was the man who created the split, essentially. Now, it took another Brit, Sylvia Payne, to patch up the split, to get Anna Freud to rejoin the British Psychoanalytic Society and to set out a compromise of parallel training schemes within the society. But the thing to remember is that it was James Strachey, in his violent attack on extremism, in the name of a kind of liberalism, dispositional liberalism, that created that situation. So James Strachey and Adrian Stephen, and Karen Stephen, between them, as core representative of Bloomsbury, and you might say, with political liberalism showing itself in this view of Bloomsbury, they had a key part in reforming the psychoanalytic society away from the Freudian Jonesian model to something more like, well, maybe an English club. Let's leave that to one side. But let's stay back with James Strachey. At the end of his life, he was engaged with completing the standard edition, but he had another big project on his hands, which was helping Michael Holroyd write the biography of Lytton Strachey. Now, many people think, and I agree with them, this is the most important biography written in the 20th century, because it was the first biography that told about life and sex and work as linked in completely together. In beautiful prose, Holroyd's prose is beautiful, and exemplary scholarship. And the exemplary scholarship consisted of Michael Holroyd visiting James Strachey down in his country house where he and Alex lived from after the war onwards. And James just opened up the back rooms, which were full of papers. And Michael Holroyd thought, well, I'm planning to spend a year on this biography. 6 years it's going to have to be. Because he and James Strachey then worked together, sorting through the papers and telling the truth about Lytton Strachey and many other people. It was published in 1967. I think it's very important which year it was published in. I think it might have been 67. And the reason why it was important is because homosexuality was legalized in that year. And the whole story of James Strachey's love affair with George Mallory. I was just looking. George Mallory, the man who died not climbing Everest, Mallory and Irving. His homosexual relationship, George Mallory's homosexual relationship, is not with James Strachey, is not mentioned in the latest prize-winning biography, because mountain climbers don't do that kind of thing. There are still people who think that. Similarly, Keynes's complicated heterosexual and homosexual relationships. This all spills out of Lytton Strachey's biography by Holroyd. And this is the point that James Strachey was working towards. He said, my own view is that Lytton's Cambridge years had an important effect on the subsequent mental life in England, especially on the attitude of ordinary people to religion and sex. The young men in my years, though also interested in socialism, were far more open-minded on both those topics than their predecessors. And I believe they handed on what they derived from Lytton, and this, taken in conjunction with Freud, who was totally unknown till much later, is, I think, what has resulted in the reform of the general attitude to sex. So, James Strachey wanted to argue that Lytton Strachey's transformation of the British attitude to sex took a long time coming, you might say, together with Freud, were the great life works in a general transformation of the British, which you might say came to fruition in 1967 with the legalization of homosexuality. So Virginia Woolf got it wrong with James Strachey. I think her perception is spot on about what kind of man he was, except that she forgot to notice, or she failed to notice, that this was a man who could really bring long-term projects to fruition if he could become roused from lethargy into committing himself to them. Holroyd's biography, Strachey's Freud, these are great projects. So, call no man a failure until he's dead. Bloomsbury, demographically a place where the couples were triangles who lived in squares. Kingsley Martin, editor of the New Statesman for many years, kind of on the edge of Bloomsbury kind of chap. He knew these people, and that's a wonderfully accurate and witty description. What I think is very important to say though about Bloomsbury is that this word I'm trying to get at, the porosity of social relations in Bloomsbury. When Adrian and Karen Stephen were living in Gordon Square, like everyone else, James and Alex next door, and Vanessa Bell further up the road, Russell's brother, also in Gordon Square, Keynes's house in Gordon Square. They always had kind of strange people living there. They had people who lived for a few weeks or months, in and out, lodgers, friends, people who were having affairs with people they really shouldn't be having affairs with. So that Karen and Adrian were always doing that. Adrian was always moving out because he was having an affair with someone else. This porosity of lives and porosity of sexual liaison, though always serious sexual liaison, they were in love. Love was the core of these relationships. And the easy way with bisexuality. This porosity, I think, is characteristic of both the sexual and social milieu of Bloomsbury. And one of the reasons why it becomes so open to psychoanalysis. This is a famous quote, again from Dear Virginia. It was a spring evening. Vanessa and I were sitting in the drawing room. At any moment, Clive might come in. Suddenly the door opened and the long and sinister figure of Mr. Lytton Strachey stood on the threshold. He pointed a finger at a stain on Vanessa's white dress. "Semen," he said. "Can one really say it?" I thought, and we burst out laughing. With that one word, all barriers of reticence and reserve went down. A flood of the sacred fluid seemed to overwhelm us. Sex permeated our conversation. The word bugger was never far from our lips. We discussed copulation with the same excitement and openness that we had discussed the nature of the good. It is strange to think how reticent, how reserved we had been, and for how long. So, what can we say about Bloomsbury, psychoanalysis and British culture? Bloomsbury was the ideal host culture for psychoanalysis. The rejection of morality. Keynes called it immoralism. And he said, that's what I am. I'm an immoralist. It's too late to change. I might regret it, but I'm an immoralist. In 1937, he gave this portrait of Bloomsbury culture. And what they'd taken from G.E. Moore, from which they took into their lives, that individual experience is the sole good in life, especially personal relationships, alongside a fundamentally aesthetic appreciation of life. Not a moral, but an aesthetic appreciation. Now, psychology became key, but this isn't academic psychology. They're searching for some other psychology. I'll give you a sense of how am I doing on time? Give you two senses from Keynes. I'm so sad that I haven't included Keynes very much in this talk. So when Keynes wrote his world famous book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace in 1919, he gave a portrait of bourgeois culture on which bourgeois capitalism of the last 50 years, which was a fundamentally psychological portrait that capitalism was based on thrift, and it was the idea of keeping things, keeping your wealth and investing it, turning it into capital. And that the core of the problems of Europe after the First World War and of European capitalism in general was based on this psychological arrangement whereby the poor saw that the rich didn't spend their money. And it was only under the condition they didn't spend their money but invested it that there was a kind of peace, a psychological peace, underlying capitalism. This he saw as endangered. Now, in 1936, in his most famous work, the General Theory, the big technical work which gave rise to Keynesian economics, he gave a different diagnosis. He said the problem with present-day capitalism is that we have anxiety about the future rather than hope. And anxiety about the future means we don't invest. We don't trust in the future. We don't trust in our grandchildren, as he put it in another famous essay. So that his diagnosis of the problems of capitalism were fundamentally psychological. There's a psychological basis to economics, beyond all the mathematics, which of course is there, which Keynes insisted upon both in 1919 and 1936. And on both occasions, more explicitly in 19, oddly enough, than 1936, he drew on Freudian psychology, as he called it, to give this account of the relationship between hope and anxiety as the foundations of economic activity. So there's a kind of requirement for psychology at the basis of Bloomsbury's openness to psychoanalysis. And you might say that what changed in the 30s was that Marxism came to stand in for this fundamental liberal psychological approach to politics and economics. The economic foundationalism of Marxism, of which Keynes, of course, disapproved, became a kind of dogma and a way of thinking about the nature of economics, which the earlier liberal economics of Keynes eschewed completely. Now, there's also the entirely different character of the reception of psychoanalysis in Britain from other countries. And you might say that Bloomsbury plays a very significant part in that character, that different reception. Because Bloomsbury provided a ready-made culture and set of institutions. The Hogarth Press being the obvious one, when Hogarth Press was set up by Leonard and Virginia in 1917 so that Virginia did typesetting in the afternoon and didn't go crazy. She was always in danger of a kind of psychotic breakdown. And they reckoned the typesetting. And it worked for many years. She only stopped her activities in Hogarth Press in 1958. So there she was setting The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot as therapy, her kind of therapy. But this meant that there was a prestigious press that would take up psychoanalysis. Contrast it with what happens in Vienna, where Freud thinks the only way to keep psychoanalysis independent and powerful is to have our own press, the Verlag, which lasted until the Nazis dismantled it in 1938. In Britain, that arrangement, which started off in the early 20s as the Verlag publishing British psychoanalysis, didn't last. Hogarth Press took it over instead. So that's one institution. And you've got this strange character of Bloomsbury. Bloomsbury, they're bohemians in a certain sort of sense, though, as W.H. Auden pointed out, they always had cut glass and servants, as well as being bohemians. They came from the best post-imperial families. At a country house weekend, there'd be Lytton Strachey being outrageous, sitting next to the Secretary of State for War. They knew the cabinet ministers. During the war, the First World War, the Bloomsbury Group would argue incessantly at their country house weekends with MPs, with cabinet ministers, with political leaders, with aristocrats. So you have this strange combination in Bloomsbury of insider-outsiders. So the other characteristic of psychoanalysis in Britain in the early years can also point to its connection with this. Very few Jews. Psychoanalysis was not an area that, as in other Central European countries, even in France, was attractive to Jews partly because of its non-establishment aura. There were a high proportion of women, but you might say that's partly because of the enormous importance of suffragism, suffragettism, feminism, of the new drive for women to find professional lives beyond the restricted lives they've been obliged to lead up to then. And then finally, of course, psychoanalysis did provide a new vocation. Adrian and James, in particular, they wandered directionless, you might say, until in their late 30s they found their métier, just after the First World War, psychoanalysis. So, that's a little portrait of Freud in Bloomsbury. I'm happy to discuss. We can discuss with Lisa, is that right? Or just take questions as we go. So let's have responses, questions about the vast things I haven't talked about in this talk so far. Thank you.
You mentioned Jean Moore, who was so important in constituting the ethos of Bloomsbury. Can you just say a little bit about him? Because I don't know that everybody here actually has a clear picture of what Jean Moore stands for.
Well, for the apostles, he stands for the repudiation of utilitarianism. He stands for repudiation of idealism as well in philosophy. So the portrait of the values of ethics, according to Moore, will be, as I pointed out, the aesthetic life is a good life. And the only real good to be found is in one's own personal experiences in connection with other people, in your friendships. So friendship becomes the highest good in life. So morality, it is conventionally understood as a set of rules, a set of codes, is gone. Principia Ethica is a way of saying the ethical life is an aesthetic one in which the values of your relationships with other people is all there is. And if it's love or hate, I mean, it can be nasty. It can be so that the passions of the Bloomsbury group would not just be nice ones. They're violent passions, violent hatreds, as well as communing, loving relationships. These, just because they are the only thing that is ethically viable and valuable, that's what Moore passed to his contemporaries, Russell and Keynes in particular, and Lytton Strachey. So, Moore is the person who founds analytic philosophy using these arguments, because he tears apart concepts. And it's that tearing apart of concepts that leads to, eventually, to the style of philosophy known as analytic philosophy, now it's 20th century Anglo-American philosophy. But the route of passage from Moore goes via Russell. And that's a different kettle of fish, because Russell is also, it comes from mathematics. And so you can't see the real strength of Moore until you combine it with Russell's mathematizing, Platonizing tendency, and the theory of logic, and the Principia Mathematica of 1910. So Moore's influence goes in two directions. It's the foundation of modern academic Anglo-American philosophy via Russell and then Wittgenstein. And it goes into the ethical life via his own work on Principia Ethica and the Bloomsbury Group, who disseminate.
Yeah, I have one more
question. There's one at the back. Yes. Well, Karen Stephen practiced. Alex Strachey, a bit on and off. I don't think she... Yes, that would certainly describe people like Ella Freeman Sharp, who was a teacher and then became an analyst. Teaching being much more of a conventional profession for women, even in the early 20th century. there are increasingly larger numbers of women training as doctors in the early 20th century, and quite an interesting proportion of the ones who come into psychoanalysis are from, as it were, that cohort, rather like Sylvia Payne. Sylvia Payne is a neurologist, and she's working in the war hospitals during the First World War, and that is what takes her into psychoanalysis. So there are different routes, but I think it's very important that the first real training centre for psychoanalysis in Britain was the Brunswick Square Clinic in Bloomsbury, which started in essentially 1915 and then closed up shop with a kind of takeover from the British Psycholytic Society, a rather nasty business in political terms in the early 20s. And now the Brunswick Square Clinic was very much led by women. I'm losing their names for some peculiar reason. But James Strachey, Adrian Stephen, Sylvia Payne, all started analyses. Susan Isaacs is another one. Started analyses at the Brunswick Square Clinic. Because that, during the war, that was the only centre for psychoanalysis. Now, it disappears a little bit from the history of psychoanalysis in Britain because of this takeover that takes place and the fact that James Glover, who became the medical director of the Brunswick Square Clinic, transferred his allegiances over to the British Psycholytic Society. And this is, you might say that this is one of the many signs of Ernest Jones's autocratic approach. He believed there should be only one kind of psychoanalysis in Britain, and it should be under his control. And he should be seen as the mouthpiece speaking from Vienna, if needs be. Though it actually was usually Ernest Jones, not Vienna speaking. The idea that there might be more than one Psychoanalytic Society in London, was completely anathema to Ernest Jones. But the women associated with the Brunswick Square Clinic had already started this before he could get anything going. So he had to do a lot of quite underhand politicking at certain points in order to achieve that unified aim, which he did. But that's why Adrian Stephen and James, well, Adrian Stephen and Karen Stephen in particular, got their historical revenge on Ernest Jones during the Second World War, because they led a revolt within the society to try and open it up. Not as much as it's now been opened up in the last 10 or 20 years. Finally, with a number of different IPA-approved institutions in Britain, training analysts.
There's a question there and then here.
Sure.
I've got a couple of points really. When you say Bloom's supposed to be ideal for psychoanalysis, I obviously appreciate everything you say about why it was so dismissed, but it wasn't altogether, I think it's their ideas in a stretch of the way, because it seems to be Bloom's was terribly immature.
It depends what you mean by progressive, doesn't it?
Well, I'm using it in maybe a subtle way, but left-wing and concerned with what particularly the kind of radical analysts in Germany and Austria are concerned with extending psychoanalysis to people who can pay, and it may be very successfully doing that. Whereas it seems to me Bloomsbury was just more concerned with itself than with other stuff like
sure.
Which is, I don't know whether you meant it so strongly, but somehow I've got the sense that you said that Little Strange is somehow responsible for the decriminalisation of homosexuality in the 60s. But actually, I think the history of how that came about in the 50s, there's an awful lot of campaigning by a lot of different people.
Sure. I didn't say that. I took the passage from James Strachey to imply that James Strachey thought that. James Strachey thought that sexual transformation of views about sexuality in Britain was a result of Freud plus Little Strachey.
It again seems like an indication that there's something closed world.
Well, everyone lives in a self-enclosed world. And one of the things I emphasised about Bloomsbury is the enormous porosity of that world. I mean, if you look at the correspondence networks of these people, they're extremely extensive. They have a lot of friends. They live in and out of each other's houses. Now, if they don't go out to the working classes, does that mean they're not progressive? It just means they don't believe in that. They certainly didn't. That wasn't what most of the Bloomsbury... They were the great and the good idea. Now, the Arts Council, we owe to John Maynard Keynes. The Arts Theatre in Cambridge and the Arts Cinema, we owe to John Maynard Keynes. The International Monetary Fund, we owe to John Maynard Keynes. So there's a little bit of outgoing somewhere. It's not just turned in upon itself. And the kind of Radio 3 culture that developed on the BBC, I would say, had a large dose of Bloomsbury in it. So there's nothing more outgoing than radio. So I think the idea of Bloomsbury has turned in upon itself. Of course, they valued personal relationships above anything else. That is very important to know. If you think that socialism is a kind of higher value than personal relationships, then you're not going to be sympathetic to the blues room. So, it's a very different culture in Britain from Berlin and Vienna. I agree with that. There were no free clinics. Well, it's not quite true. Those analysts who worked for this Institute of Psychoanalysis clinic worked for free. And patients there, clinic patients, were charged very low rates. There wasn't an ideology of socialism associated with that. There was an ideal of medical philanthropy associated with that. Because that's what hospital consultants used to do from the mid-18th century onwards, the philanthropic hospitals. And the idea of a consultant in British medicine is someone who does it for free. That's what it means to be a consultant. So that the British Psychoanalytic Society took its traditions from the medical traditions of British medicine. You're absolutely right, that's a completely different cultural ambience. That's why the Bloomsbury group, with its liberal rather than progressive, whatever that means, but there's a problem about progressive because, the Labour Party, Leonard Woolf is an extremely important figure in the early years of the Labour Party, but the Labour Party is very ambiguously socialist in Britain. I mean, it's very difficult to map it straightforwardly in the 1920s onto a European model. But let's leave that discussion to one side. I think Britain is a very different culture. Yes?
Small question about Freud. The Bloomsbury group functioned over a number of years, but clearly the beginning seemed to precede the death of Freud. Did he acknowledge them? What he thought about them? Was there personal? I know there was some personal intercourse when it came to Virginia and Leonard and him and the publication. But how did it look from his side?
Freud, I worked it out in 1922, 40% of Freud's caseload was English and 40% was American. 40% caseload was John Rickman, James Strachey, Joan Riviere, Alex Strachey, Arthur Tansley. So, when Sebastian Sprott, who was Keynes's lover, Strachey's lover, a psychologist at Cambridge in the early 20s, went into the Austrian Alps to visit Freud and invited him to Cambridge, Freud immediately wrote to Dennis Jones and said, this young man who's an acolyte of Maynard Keynes has invited me to Cambridge. It's a nice idea. Freud knew exactly who his clientele in England were. I mean, he knew their fathers, their mothers, their lovers. Of course he did. He heard it from the Count. He knew exactly the social milieu, the habits, and this was one of the things he appreciated most about them. So when he talks about James Strachey, he says he comes from a very good family. He knows that that's the way you talk about people in England. He knows exactly which family they come from. And Lytton Strachey gave a psychoanalytic interpretation, which Freud, of the relationship between Elizabeth I and the Earl of Essex, who perhaps her would-be lover who she had executed. In Lytton Strachey's book, Elizabeth and Essex, Freud was very touched and complimented, flattered by the fact that Lytton Strachey, who was this grand literary figure in England, was just using this psychoanalytic theory in order to retell the story of a key passage in Elizabethan history. So Freud knew exactly who he was dealing with. And so the question is, did Freud know about what kind of culture he walked into? Mm. Yes. He extremely intimate.
Screen. I saw the people who were psychoanalyzed, Alexander in Cambridge. I saw two names, Huntley and Ramsey. I was struck that these two names are the character, the two major characters in the lighthouse.
Of course.
And I just wonder, to the light it says, I mean, these characters are nothing to the psychoanalysis, but of course, but it said that writing to the lighthouse did. What did for her psychoanalyst?
Yeah.
So, but just curious that this theology, these two names, and I wonder who are they? Just of course, curious.
Well, Sir Arthur Tansley.
Yeah.
Was the botanist and the founder of ecology in Britain, and he was actually, in the same way as Keynes was the founder of the Arts Council, Tansley was the founder of the Nature Conservancy, the first president. And he gave up his botanical career to become a psychoanalyst, and then went back to being professor of botany at Oxford in 1927. Ramsay, who some people in Cambridge, my university, call the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, Ramsay died at the age of 26. Having made major contributions to logic, mathematics, philosophy, and economics, as a Frank Ramsay Chair of Economics in Cambridge, taxation theory, very heavy-duty mathematics, because he did that very, very straightforward. But he had analysis because he fell in love when he was 21 with a married woman, and got so unhappy that he just went off to Vienna and had analysis with Theodor Reich. Now, he also spent a lot of time with Wittgenstein there, and he'd already translated at the age of 18 Wittgenstein's Tractatus into English. So, Ramsay and Tansley, as you say, key figures in To the Lighthouse. And is it just at that moment that Virginia Woolf is running into them? She sees them, meets up with them. Ramsay, because he's an apostle, and when she meets Ramsay, she says, he's the most perfect apostle you could ever imagine. He is the quintessence of apostledom. So he embodies these Cambridge values, mathematical truth, clarity, the ethics of relationships in himself. Sadly, he died. He was Wittgenstein's supervisor when Wittgenstein returned to Cambridge, but he died in 1930. Now, I agree with you, the coincidence is very striking. But we don't know. You know, October 1924 is when she has the walk around Tavistock Square, and the bubbles come, and she dreams up to the lighthouse. But, you know, To the Lighthouse is about her brother. Yeah, but you know there is this wonderful passage in the Hyde Park Gate Muse, which the Stephen children published in 1890, I think it was, in which it says, Master Adrian was very upset because he was not allowed to go to the lighthouse, and she later, on a number of occasions, she does say, this book, as it were, freed me of my mother. But it most obviously is built around her brother. And her brother at that moment is going through his psychoanalysis and finishes in the year that she publishes To the Lighthouse, 1927. I don't want to say, To the Lighthouse is a masterpiece. It's about many, many things. But certainly it's about how rather not getting to the Lighthouse.
Yeah. This 1910 is also the year when the Psycho-Analytical Society was established.
No. 1913.
No, 1910. No, 1910. It's not in England. It's international.
Yeah, the International Psychoanalytic Association is formed in 1910. I look forward to reading.
One more question?
Yes.
I don't know what you're asking. Did you say that there was an access card?
Are you thinking of Virginia Woolf? I don't think misogyny was a category they used very much.
I don't know that.
To talk about this, we might wander into territory that's bizarre. We might make claims like all homosexuals despise members of the opposite sex. Would we want to start off by saying that? What happens to a homosexual when they become a heterosexual? As John Maynard Keynes did. What happens to Virginia Woolf when she stops being a heterosexual and becomes a homosexual? One of the things that's most interesting about the Bloomsbury group is that despite much social disapproval and illegality, they paid no attention whatsoever to whether you were having sexual or amorous relations with persons of the same sex or the opposite. They were completely, as we would say, gender blind or object blind in this respect. Which you would have thought undercuts the idea of a general misogyny. Unless you really think that in order to go to bed, for a male to go to bed with a male, you have to despise women. Which is a very big ask. Misogyny seems the last thing I would say about the Bloomsbury group. Misanthropy, maybe. I've never come across it. I'd like to see chapter and verse. And the context for it as well.
John, this has been terrific. And I just, perhaps in closing, because perhaps people also came to hear that, you might just say a little bit about Virginia's own relationship to being mad, bad, and sad in some way, or to the doctors and to analysis in general. And then,
okay. So, one of the standard parts of the literature on Bloomsbury and psychoanalysis, which is very extensive, says, well, if Bloomsbury cared so much about psychoanalysis, why didn't Virginia Woolf, who was mentally troubled for most of her life, have psychoanalysis? Seems like a good question. You might say she steered clear. She deliberately steered clear. But what about her nearest and dearest? So there's a literature, many books thick, on her psychiatric treatment. With some major claims, you know, major claims that Virginia Woolf was psychiatrically disturbed because she'd been abused in her youth by her cousin, sexually abused. And then various criticisms of the management of her mental illness, usually by kind of in an anti-psychiatric mode, by criticizing the psychiatrists of the day for the useless and sometimes horrible things they did to her. But one of the things I have discovered, and I've never seen this in print, is that one of her early doctors was in fact a psychoanalyst. His name was Dr. Morris Wright. And nobody has noticed that he was one of the founder members of the London Psychoanalytic Society in 1913. And in fact, Ernest Jones says somewhere, I think in a paper in 1945, he said, while I was away in Canada, there were only four people doing psychoanalysis in London. And he names David Forsyth, the guy who moved to India, Michael, tell me. Sorry? No. That's another of my Cambridge people. That's another Indian, but this is another one. But anyway, the fourth of these is Morris Wright. Morris Wright was a psychoanalyst who joined the Psychoanalytic Society at its foundation in 1913, joined the British Psychoanalytic Society in 1919, and remained a full member, until the late 40s. To give you a sense of what kind of man he was a society physician, a general practitioner, he was called. But he worked at the Tavistock Clinic for 20 years as a key consultant there. And he gave talks about Freud and its relationship to medicine. Now, he was the physician that Virginia Woolf consulted after her engagement, but before her marriage, which is actually a key moment in her psychiatric ups and downs. So, if anyone could have said, now is the moment to start an analysis, it would have been Morris Wright. But she said, we don't know what went on in that consultation. She saw him on a number of occasions later. But the one thing you can no longer say, as far as I'm concerned, is that Leonard Woolf and others steered Virginia Woolf away from psychoanalysis. Because one of her key doctors was already a psychoanalyst. Now, another of her key doctors, there are two more important ones, is Maurice Craig over there, along with Savage, who's actually the principal doctor, who's more likely to be the person portrayed in Mrs. Dalloway. Sorry?
Savage is earlier
and later. But Maurice Craig is also not a conventional psychiatrist in a straightforward sense, because he's deeply involved in the setting up of the Diploma in Psychological Medicine, along with W.H.R. Rivers, and C.S. Myers in 1911, 12, and 13 in Cambridge. So he, like Rivers and Myers, knows about psychoanalysis way back when he's having an important influence on Virginia Woolf's treatment. So the question why Virginia Woolf never had psychoanalysis is one I think that Virginia Woolf in the end would have to answer. Which is always the case when it comes to why you do and you don't have psychoanalysis. I don't think there's a plot about keeping her away from psychoanalysis. But bear in mind what Alex Strachey said. Alex Strachey said, perhaps it would have done her harm. It might have taken away some element of the madness that went into her creativity. Alex was a very close friend of Virginia Woolf's. And she said that in the 1930s. So they may have been thinking like that in Virginia Woolf's circle, and it may have been Virginia Woolf herself who said this, who thought this about herself. Is this too dangerous for me? Who knows? We don't have sufficient evidence.
Yeah, but there's certainly that belief in herself and the Leonard and the surrounding people that her genius, creativity is something to be happy. Freudian psychoanalysis is to deal with neurosis rather than psychosis.
There's no difference between a neurosis and a psychosis in psychiatric literature of the period.
Yeah, but the...
So that's a retrospective diagnosis.
Right, but her problem is the sort of everybody regarded sort of take some kind of gene in her and so on, something incurable to this form incurable.
Freud's paper of 1894 is called The Neuropsychoses of Defense. Very important paper. And Freud's distinction between neurosis and psychosis is complex, as is psychiatry's, throughout this period from the 1890s to the 1920s. The key distinction between transference neurosis and narcissistic neurosis in psychoanalytic theory only comes in the 1920s. Tens. But Freud was undoubtedly treating people we would call psychotic in the 1890s, 1900s. So whatever Virginia Woolf had, no one will ever know, and I'm not a great fan of retrospective diagnosis, historical retrospective diagnosis. There would have been no policeman saying, oh, that's psychotic, can't do that with psychoanalysis. What this is very confused by is that the crucial thing in England is whether you're certifiable, not whether you're psychotic. And certification requires the intervention of a magistrate. And the principal psychiatric action of the period would be whether to certify a person, in other words, to confine them against their will. And some of the activity that goes on around Virginia Woolf is of keeping her confined, perhaps against her will. So that we're not talking about psychosis, we're talking about the proximity of the legal category of certification.
Yes.
She did. And that's the model. So it's a certification model. And debates about neurosis or psychosis are relatively minor and beside the point.
Okay. We're going to let you go, John. So thank you from everyone and for a very interesting, stimulating lecture.
Thank you for your very interesting question.